Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, wow. Live from Studio G in Greenville, South Carolina. It is the one and only Murder 123. This is Dr. John Stamey. We've got a packed house tonight. All the hosts are here and our guest is here. And I'll tell you how much I love this show. I have turned off the national championship as my Clemson Tigers are losing. And I'm getting pictures from the stadium of my buddies that I went to school with down there showing how upset they are. I said, well, whatever. I'm going to go do Murder 123, and they didn't understand that. So anyway, some of them are going to be listening in. Glad to have all you guys down there in New Orleans. And we're here to discuss some of the most incredible murders that have ever happened and some of the strange circumstances around which they have been. So anyway, it's good to be here, not see you. It's good to see everybody online, and I will go down the roster. First of all, ladies first, Robin McCray, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing great. Looking forward to another show.
That's great. Now, how are the animals, all 99 of them?
They are all doing good. We had another foot out in the front yard tonight, so nobody wants to go outside. So they're all hunkered in for the night.
Okay.
And
well,
our wonderful wildcat is sitting here watching, getting ready to listen to the show.
Well, good. Well, we want him listening to the show. He's our good luck charm.
He is.
I mean, he's better than a bowl full of Lucky Charms.
He's so precious.
That's great. Well, we're glad to have you here from Hollywood, the one and only Devin Tate. How are you doing tonight, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing really well. So glad to be here. And hearing Robin talk about her animals reminded me there's a story in the news today about a cat here in L.A. who fought off three coyotes that came into the cat's backyard. There's video
of
it. You gotta check it out. This cat totally, scares off these three coyotes that are trying to fight it.
I'm going to look for that.
It's crazy.
That's awesome.
I guess it was a bad day to be a coyote, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, well. And from the murder capital of the United States, the one and only Tony Filosi from Harlan County, Kentucky. How you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to the show.
Hey, Tony.
Hey.
That was funny. Tony and I were talking last week. I think I mentioned this. He said, well, you better hope I stay in Harlan County and I'll never lack for a murder to talk about. So that's great. And it's wonderful. We're glad to have you here, Tony. And our guest tonight, I'll tell you how I met him. It's really cool. This is Michael Smith, and he's from Greater Myrtle Beach. That's what the people in Conway like to say sometimes. Michael, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, sir. How are y'all?
We're good.
And I'm
very glad to have you here.
And I'll tell you how I met Michael. Michael was part of a company that got Scarycast onto iHeartRadio. So
awesome.
That's exactly right. So I want to thank Michael for that forever, and it's wonderful to have him on the show. I was talking to him one day about Scarycast, and then I said, and you know what? We got a brand new show called Murder 123. We like to talk about interesting murders. And the first thing he said was, boy, do I have a story about Kurt Cobain. Now, for those of you that may not know, Kurt Cobain was the lead vocalist and songwriter for Nirvana, the great early 90s rock band. So Michael has got an interesting story about the investigation of investigative work that he did about Kurt Cobain. So I'm going to turn the conversation over to Michael to tell us how did the murder go down, and then what did you do to get involved?
Well, I guess first off, I wouldn't have been in this if it hadn't been from a research partner, Joel Walling, who was also was the person that actually founded the group that helped get your podcast going. And he said one day, he says, we should look at the Kurt Cobain thing. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, I had no clue. I never heard of it. I mean, I knew who Kurt Cobain was, vaguely, but I didn't have any details. Didn't know anything about anything, really. He said, well, there's always been speculation that he was murdered, that it wasn't a suicide, like it was ruled. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, we should look at that. I said, all right, we'll look at it. So, us being us, we did. And I have to say up front that this case is very polarizing. There are people who believe he was murdered. There are people who believe he committed suicide. And never the twain shall meet. You're not going to flip those people to the other way of thinking most of the time. We went into this thing with no preconceived notion. I still don't have one. I looked at the case file. The case files for this case are online. Anybody can look at them. They're from the Seattle Police Department because they had such a huge amount of people requesting information for this, doing books and movies and TV shows and whatever, their own research, that they put the case file online. It was like 5 zip files and a photo file of crime scene photos. Now, the crime scene photos do not show the body. You know, they don't show any blood and gore or nothing like that, but you can read everything about this case that they have online. And that's where we took our information from. That's what we used as a baseline to look at for things that to us didn't make sense or fit one thought and didn't fit another. That's how we started. I don't propose to say that any one person committed any crime. I'm not for or against Courtney Love. I'm not for or against Tom Grant, who was the private investigator that she hired after Kurt Cobain left rehab in L.A. and went to Seattle to find him. I'm not in any way for or against either one of those people. I have no agenda. We just followed the case file. That was all. Wherever it led, whatever questions we found, we tried to answer for ourselves. Somebody else could look at it and maybe get 1,000 more questions that we didn't get. But the questions that we came up with are the ones that we looked at.
Okay.
There were several things that we started with. The first thing was that when Kurt Cobain left rehab on April 2nd, 1994, he bought an airline ticket from LAX from Los Angeles to Seattle Tacoma, SeaTac. And it was for $478. And that purchase was made at 8:07 p.m. Now, I've got in this case file, there is a copy of the credit card statement showing the charges that were made from April 1st all the way to April 8th. After that charge was made, Courtney Love had that card stopped. She had a hold put on it so it couldn't be used. So no other charge was made on that card after that time. Nothing was processed. According to this sheet here, there were several charges that were attempted that didn't go through. Now, supposedly, according to what I've seen, what other people have said online and in books and what have you, Kurt Cobain only had one credit card. And if he purchased the ticket that he flew to Seattle with, that's all well and good. She canceled the card, and so he had a card that was not workable. It wasn't active. Are you following me so far?
Yes, sir.
The thing of it is this. she hired Tom Grant, the private investigator, to track him down because of the fraudulent, there were charges coming through on the card that weren't, you know, the fraudulent card charges was part of the deal. And also to find Kurt. But when Courtney Love was, she had a drug incident at her hotel and she was arrested. And when she was booked on April the 7th at 3 p.m., on the booking form, there was a section for the things in possession at the time, and listed on that list is one credit card, name of Kurt Cobain, MasterCard, one MasterCard. So the question I had was this, and Joe and I both had this question. If Kurt had the card and bought the ticket on the 1st when he left L.A. to go to Seattle, how did she get it, have it on the 7th in Los Angeles if she didn't see him?
Well,
if she bought the ticket for him.
Good point.
If she bought the ticket for him in L.A. over the phone or however it was bought, then she knew she did it. So she knew he had left rehab. So it wouldn't have been a surprise for her to find that he left rehab because she would have known it. But she would have been the one who had bought the ticket because she had the card. If, in fact, it was the only card. Some people say he only had one card and that was it, and they both used it. That's plausible. I don't know how many cards he had. I know that a card was actually, one of his cards was actually sold at auction a number of years after that. But I don't know how many he had at the time of his death. But there's also this to consider. On this charge list for the credit card, the attempted charges, and there were several. There were like cash advances that were declined, you know, picked card up because it had been deactivated. According to the police report, all those attempted transactions were made over the phone. So there was no way they could track the card to a location. They didn't know where the card physically was when it was attempted to be used. After his body was found and all his possessions were taken into evidence in Seattle PD, they had Seattle PD check his wallet and they found no credit card. They did find two debit cards, like the cash advance cards like we'd use for an ATM machine.
Yeah.
He had two cash advance cards with two different account numbers on them. Now, I'm not an expert on credit cards or anything like that or banking, but normally if you have a card with two different account numbers on it, card numbers, it means it's from two different accounts, I would think. I don't know that for sure. I've never been able to figure that out. But he did not have a credit card on him when they found his body.
Yes, now Robin had a statement, and then I wanted to make a comment. Yes, Robin?
Well, on those debit cards, did they both have his name on it?
As far as it's listed here, yes.
Okay, because if there's two different numbers on it, I mean, like my husband and I, we have an account, and our debit cards have the same account, but it has two completely different numbers on it. But there's also two different names. If you're going to if it's the same account, you aren't going to have your name for two different numbers on the same account.
Yeah, that was my thought, too. You'd have two cards. You might have two cards with your same name, and two numbers means you have two accounts, would be what I would think.
Right.
But if he had two accounts, did he have a Visa card to go with each account or just one? We don't know because the credit card numbers are blacked out. I don't have those. I can't get those. So I don't know. I can't say one way or the other.
Well,
but it is strange.
Like I said, for one account, you can have two debit cards with two different numbers if it's for two different people. But they aren't going to give him the same numbers or different numbers and have his name on both cards for one account. So it has to have, if his name was indeed on both cards, it has to be two separate ones.
Unless,
yeah, that's what I thought too.
But now here's something that happens to me frequently. A lot of times I will misplace my bank bag with my cards in it, and I will call and I will stop the debit cards in there. And then 2 days later, someone will show up with it. They'll find it. They'll return it to me. So I do have in my wallet
two different account numbers
on it with one name on it. And they go to one account. One is not active, and the other one is. And I've got the one flagged.
I
keep
mean,
that
active
one.
Account. Yeah.
One active account.
Yeah.
One active card, and then the other one is inactive.
See,
right.
We even thought about that. We don't know though. We couldn't track that down. Except to us, it seems strange. But the main thing for us was, if he had the card when he left L.A. How did Courtney get it a week later unless she saw him? Or
well,
unless someone took the card from him to get back to her? Because
well,
according to what she said,
is,
she didn't see him between that time.
Like, I have an American Express card, and Pat doesn't, and it's an account from when before we got married. And I hardly ever use it, so I've never added him on it. I called to have him added. It was so much stuff to go through to add him, so I just left it alone. And I have a picture of it, so I've got my numbers on the front and the back, and if he's going to use it, I send it with him. But I have all those numbers. Now, you can get an airline ticket by going online. I mean, I do that all the time, and you buy it online. And when you go to pick it up, all you got to have is your license. You don't have to have that card because it's already been paid for. So he may
not necessarily
have to have the card.
We thought about that, too, but then, you know, why did she bother to cancel a card that she already had? If she was afraid he was going to use it, he couldn't have used it if she had it.
Exactly.
So why did she cancel it?
He could have online used it, but...
Maybe. But if he had no cash, you know, I mean, I'm just saying, it doesn't add up that the whole card thing... And the fraudulent charges that were attempted don't make any sense. Even the bank says in the report that their computers had an issue and they can't account for the way these charges came down. They can't verify where the card was at, if it was in Seattle or if it was in L.A. or I don't know.
Well, the thing that's weird is why did she even stop the charges? Because if supposedly... Even if he had the numbers and it was his card to begin with, so who is she or why would she even stop the charges? I mean, whether he had the card or whether or not he was ordering stuff online or whatever the possibility is, it's his card. So she would have no business canceling it.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff that come up. You know, I mean, we looked at all the angles on this. I guess she figured if she had control over the money, he'd have to surface because he wouldn't have any money to do anything with. Is all we could think of. I don't know.
Well,
if he was in Seattle and his bank was in Seattle, he had an account there, he could walk into any branch of the bank with a driver's license and get a cash withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Michael,
you know,
I got a question for you, Michael. Not a bit of this argument makes sense that you're introducing this. Wasn't all this done at the coroner's inquest? Did they not ask these questions?
As far as I know, it was ruled a suicide the day of they found the body and the coroner signed off on it. There was no further investigation done. The investigation done by Seattle PD was full of holes.
This sounds just like Chris Benoit down there in Fayetteville, Georgia. I mean, you know, that they imported a coroner from West Virginia. Case was closed after 3 days. And now that, you know, there was so many loopholes. I mean, you know, Rob Kellum, Popstro Maestro, he interjected all these things that, and it's like when you get a celebrity death, it appears as though there are many times they want to close this case as quickly as possible. Like Jeffrey Epstein,
well, actually,
right?
In this case, Seattle is the only Washington State is the only state of the 50, as far as I know, where a death certificate and an autopsy report are not public record. Well, I cannot get a copy of the autopsy report. You have to be immediate family to get that. But there is a notation made here in the case investigation report. The assistant medical examiner was prepared by Dr. Nicholas Hartshorn, who was deceased. He died in a base jumping accident. Oddly enough, he was actually a friend of Courtney Love. They had been friends for years, as far as we could tell. And he was the one that approved. The report was prepared and approved by him, which to me that would have been a conflict of interest, but I don't know. And it basically just states in here, and I'll read this to you. Let's see here. They ruled the death classified as suicide. The pathological diagnosis also some evidence of drug use, including needle tracks and fresh needle puncture wounds. Blood test results indicate morphine level 1.52 milligrams per milliliter or per liter of blood. Blood alcohol was negative. It also states that that's extremely, that's a high opioid level, but for a person who was a frequent drug user, that level in of itself, a meaningless number. Everyone says, all right, he couldn't have shot himself if he had shot up first with that much heroin, which is morphine, because he would have been out of it too much to do it. Well, that's not so, because if he has a high tolerance for the drug and taken so much of it, the amount that he could have taken and still functioned enough to do that would have been much more than, say, maybe if you or I had taken it. You know, so you really can't say that as an ironclad fact. There are other things. I mean, there's the issue of the firearm that he used, and if you want, I'll be glad to go into that.
Yeah, I tell you what,
we
Michael.
We mentioned the credit card first only because it was the baseline for why she hired Tom Grant, was to track down the fraudulent charges on the card and to locate Kirk. As a secondary thing.
All right, now Michael, I need to stop you for a minute. I want to see if Tony or Devin have any questions or comments before we move on to the gun.
Okay, please do. Go ahead.
Yep. All right, Devin, what do you think?
I'm just listening here. It's all kind of new to me. I haven't really delved into this much, so it's very, really fascinating to me here.
It is baffling. It doesn't make any sense. All right.
Yeah.
Tony, does this make any sense to you?
No, it doesn't. But what was the date, again, that Courtney Love was arrested for drugs in her hotel room?
That was April 7th of 94.
So Bain has probably been dead a couple of days. According, they think he died around April 5th and found the 8th.
Yeah, on or about that, yes.
So Cobain would have been dead. So it was possible Cobain had been dead for 2 days. So she could very well have came up with with the card easily if from someone else, or if she would, if she had been there.
Well, do we know if she flew up to Seattle, got the card, caused something nefarious, and came back? Do we have any travel records for Courtney Love?
We thought about that, but there was no way we could track that.
Okay, but here's another thing. If she had anything to do with this, she is a celebrity, which means no matter where she goes, she draws attention. So if she has anything to do with it, I would almost bet you she would have somebody else do the dirty work for her. So it would be under her orders, but it would be someone that is not so attractive to the public eye that nobody's looking around for, and they would report back to her. And if they did have anything to do with it, they could have easily gotten the card and given it back to her after it was over.
By all means, if in fact Kurt had the card and it had gotten back to her, if it was the same card, and that's an assumption. I don't like to assume things because I don't know. But if it was, the only way that card could have gotten from Kurt back to her was if someone took it to her or she was there and took it from him. Those are the only two options. But if she was in L.A. the whole time and didn't leave, and records that we have indicate she was in L.A., then someone else would have had to have done it, taking the card from Kurt to give to her. But if, in fact, that happened, if someone took the card out of his wallet after he was dead and took it back to her, then you have a conspiracy because the body wasn't found by one of her friends. It was found by a lighting technician for an alarm company that she hired to install lights and a security system on the greenhouse where his body was. That's how the body was found.
Well, now here's another question. If he had heroin, he had to buy it from somebody, and he had to have money to buy it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
He had, when his body was found, with, laying next to him beside the shotgun, there was the drug paraphernalia, and there was some amount of cash, and I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it was around $67, I think. And we don't know how much cash he had before that, but yeah, he bought the drugs from somebody. And then whatever was left, he had. Now, there's other things, too.
Michael, or somebody gave him the drug.
Yeah,
that's
entirely possible.
This is Kurt Cobain. He can get anybody to give him anything.
Oh, yeah, he can get drugs.
100% broke, and he could get any of the people around him to get him anything he wanted.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
it's credit should be good with the drug dealer.
Well, you know, if you want, I can go into the gun a little bit. Kurt Cobain was a gun guy. He had guns. He was a target shooter. He had them for protection at home, and whatnot. And all his guns, there was an incident. A domestic incident with Courtney, and because of that, the Seattle PD took the guns into safekeeping.
Sure.
So he had no firearms. Before he left Seattle to go to LA to go into rehab, he went out with his friend Dylan Carlson to a gun store. And they bought the shotgun that was used when he died. And it was bought in Dylan Carlson's name. It was not registered to Kurt Cobain. It was a box of the gun and a box of shells. It was a 20-gauge shotgun. And he bought the gun, a box of shells, and a gun case. Well, when he got ready to leave to go to the airport to go to L.A. from Seattle, he had the shotgun shells with him in his pocket or whatever. And he realized he had them, and he couldn't take them on the airplane. Even then, you know, you couldn't take shotgun shells on an airplane, you know.
Yeah.
So he gave those shotgun shells to the cab driver to put them to the airport. And then before his death, a person, and I'm not going to say who it was because I don't know. If you give me 1 second, I'll read you this section of the police report here. This is a statement from the cab company. And this was dated, let's see here, 4/2/94, which was the day he arrived, it looks like. It's the day after, actually. At 7:30 in the morning, 7:30 hours, the driver picked up a person who he thought did not match the address of Kurt Cobain's house, because I guess he'd been there before, this driver. So the person who did not match with the address, with the residence, he drove around looking for a place to buy bullets, but was unable to find one. This male told the driver that he recently had a burglary and needed bullets. At 0:30, the driver dropped the man off in the area of 145th and Aurora because he said he was hungry and wanted to get something to eat. The fare was $27. Okay, you with me so far?
Yep.
Well, okay. Kurt Cobain was with Dylan Carlson when he bought the gun. He would have known where to go buy shells because he knew where he got them before. He wouldn't have had to go on a scavenger hunt in Seattle to buy shells for shotguns. A gun guy wouldn't need to. A gun guy knows where to buy gun stuff. Like a guitar player knows where to go buy guitar strings. A golfer knows where to go buy golf clubs. A gun guy knows where to go get gun stuff. He knew where he bought the gun to start with. So he wouldn't have had a problem going there to buy shells. And on top of that, the only thing that does match is this. Around the area of 145th and Aurora, there's a Denny's restaurant. The suicide note that was found on the scene was written on the back of a Denny's paper placemat you get at the Denny's restaurant. They're big, long, they're just paper. There's a Denny's on one side or whatever, and they got oval or something, and the back side is blank. That's what the suicide note was written on. There's a Denny's right there in that area. So that kind of points for that. But in any event, it doesn't say where the shells came from. They don't say that they didn't find them, they dropped them off or whatever. But on the scene, when the body was found, there was a box of shotgun shells. So that would tend to believe that somebody found a box of shotgun shells, because you can't fire the gun without shells. Let me get here to these photos, and I'll see if I can pull it up and take a look at it real quick, give some more information on that. That whole thing there didn't make sense either, because a gun person wouldn't have had to look all over to find gun shells, and also he wouldn't have went that early in the morning, because most places like that don't open till 9 o'clock. You know what I mean? I mean, it would make sense to go a little bit later than what you were. But that's neither here nor there. It's just one of those things that didn't add up to us. We could never. We could never figure that out.
All right, Michael, hold on a minute. I want to ask you something. And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to this question. Has anyone ever written a book about the death of Kurt Cobain?
Oh, many, from what I understand.
Okay. Right. Okay, that was a rhetorical question. Now, you have been asking questions and identifying things that sound highly suspicious. Are these the same questions that have been asked by those who wrote these books?
From what I've read, and I haven't read every book that's been written or seen every movie or every documentary, but a lot of people that go into it in one camp or the other. You know what I mean? They either believe that it was a murder and that Courtney Love had something to do with it or somebody else, or it was a suicide and that's all it was. See, I don't have an opinion on that. I have no preconceived notion. Either Joe or I either did have a notion of what happened. We just looked at the case and whatever questions we came up with, you know, is what we came up with. And some of the people have pointed out some of the stuff we looked at, but some of the stuff has never been asked. At least if it was asked, it was never answered. There's issues with, the shotgun was a 20 gauge, 2¾ inch, which means that it would fire 2¾ inch or shorter shells. But the autopsy report, or the ballistics report, I'm sorry, the ballistics report has it listed as the shotgun shells that were sent for inspection as 20 gauge, 2½ inch. That's wrong. The report in itself is filled out wrong. Where they put 2½ inches as the length of the shell should actually have been 2¾. 2½ is actually the dram weight of the powder in the shell. So the report in itself on its face is wrong. And I've got a copy of the ballistics report here. Remington shotgun shell. Remington shotgun was empty, not loaded. Let's see. It had a two-round magazine, which means you can put two in the magazine and one in the chamber for a total of three. Had a functional safety. A 22-inch barrel fitted with a compensator that took care of the mobile flash for an overall length of 45⅝ inches. It says here, one Remington Model 11 Sportsman 20 gauge self-loading semi-automatic shotgun, bearing steel number 108-8925. One fired Winchester AA 20 gauge 2½ inch shotgun shell. That was not a 2½ inch shell, it was a 2¾ inch shell, because the box of shells on the seam was 2¾ inch. Now,
so they didn't match
according to the police report. Well, according to them, initially it was said that the gun had been destroyed.
How?
After we found this, I'm getting to that. Courtney had all Kurt's guns destroyed, the ones that had been taken in to the PD for safekeeping. She had those destroyed by Mothers Against Violence or something like that. the gun that he was used when he died was evidence in a crime, even though it's suicide or whatever, it can't be destroyed. But initially they thought the gun had been destroyed. When we called, because I called the Seattle PD, and I talked to someone in homicide, and I told them, I said, look, I'm not a nut job. I'm not a groupie. I have no agenda here. I'm just telling you that your ballistics report is wrong. Told them what it said. Well, mysteriously, the gun turned up. They found the gun. It's on the website. The Cobain gun found after however many years. Unfortunately, the gun is locked up. It's been in the Seattle climate for so long in the damp that it's frozen open. It can never be fired again. There's no way you can ever test fire it again. It's cold. But if, according to the report, boxes of shotgun shells normally have 20 shells or 25 in a box, or 25 shells in this box, 25 shells in the box of shotgun shells, unless it's otherwise noted. So if there was 3 in the gun, that would leave 22 in the box, 2 in the chamber, or 2 in the magazine, and 1 fired, equal 25. That takes care of that. The thing they didn't check was this. Remember I told you that he gave the first box of shells to the cab driver?
Yep.
They never took those back from the cab driver and counted them to see how many were in that box. Suppose he loaded the gun out of the first box of shells. Okay? Means it'd be 3 short.
Right, and the second question would be, why did he load, if he jumped, shoot himself in the head, why did he fully load the gun? Why did he put 3 shells in?
Well, there's that question, too. You're not going to be fired but one time.
Well, exactly.
And also, when the gun was fired, the body had what was known as a cadaveric spasm. What it basically is the hand... The hand clenched the gun so tight, it locked up. It locked into position around the barrel, like a vice grip around the barrel. Okay? And people have had questions, well, if that happened, would the gun have jammed? Well, they couldn't prove or disprove that. There's all kind of questions about this stuff,
but Michael, how can you even contemplate this and prove it all in 24 hours?
You can't.
I know.
What was his shoes on? That's an odd question, though. But how did he pull the trigger? You're holding a long gun. And you're having to hold it up under your chin, and you're having to reach weight. You're either going to pull the trigger with your toe, or you're going to reach way down and hit it with your thumb.
You're a smart guy. You thought just like we did. His shoes were on.
Okay. So what about the fingerprints on the gun?
Right now, the position of the hand.
There's more.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The hand position on the gun, was it like a defensive, like...
One hand was on the barrel, like up on the barrel, like if you had the gun under your chin and had one hand on the barrel, hold it up under... And the other hand was down towards the receiver, as far as we can tell from the autopsy photos. The thing about the fingerprints is this. There were no fingerprints on the gun because they screwed the pooch. They tested the gun with Rhodamine G6. Rhodamine G6 basically is the chemical compound in super glue. Did you ever watch Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy? Remember when he took the super glue in the matchbook in the turtle's cage and did the thing and the print showed up? The fumes from the super glue right here to the matchbook and the print showed up? Well, that's what happened. That's how they tested the gun. They tested the gun with the rhodamine, which is super glue. It's a compound in super glue. Okay? The problem is first off, that testing method, they actually got a letter from the state crime lab not to use that procedure, again, on anything before they tested the gun, and they still did it. But by testing the gun with the rhodamine, they screwed it up so no other prints could be lifted. No prints were found on the gun.
A couple
were too
things.
Smudged.
Was he shot under the chin or in the forehead area?
As far as we can tell, it was more of the mouth and chin area. The file does not give an exact state of that, and because the autopsy photos and the crime scene photos are not public record, I can't see them, so I can't tell you. It did say on there, though, that even with the shotgun injury, that he was clearly identifiable with his driver's license, which was in his wallet. They pulled the driver's license out of his wallet and verified it against his face. So his face had to be in good enough condition for him to verify it with the driver's license. So
at that close range, that even though it's a shotgun, the pellets in the wadding are going to be like one projectile. It's going to be like one giant projectile that probably jerked his jaw off and blew the top of his head off. But
it would have been a mess. I mean, it's a shotgun. It doesn't matter if it's a 20-gauge or a 12-gauge or a 410 or a 16 or whatever. I mean, at close range, it's going to make a bloody damn mess. You know, so the whole thing with the shotgun was just, I mean, that was a bit of a cluster all the way around again. And they didn't even, I don't think they even printed the shotgun for, God, it was a long time after the case before they even tried to print the gun. Maybe it wasn't even something that was done early. That was something that was done much later. I mean, it just, there's so many things that just, to us, just did not add up. It wasn't enough to say that any one individual had done something, but you couldn't have made it look more suspicious if you tried.
Tom it's unusual, Grant, to say the least.
The private investigator, Tom Grant, was at the house. And actually went in the house with another person to look around, and supposedly the body was actually in the house at that time. They didn't find it. They didn't go to the greenhouse. Grant said he didn't know the greenhouse was there. They went at night. Went at night. Kind of went in, and of course they took him there. Never mentioned the greenhouse. Searched the whole house according to Grant, but didn't find the body. So then they go to this room over the garage. And then Grant heard on the radio the next morning that the body of Kurt Cobain had been found. And he asked the guy, hey, we were there this late last night. We didn't find it. Why didn't we look in the greenhouse? The guy said something like, oh, it was just a room full of wood and dirt. I didn't think it was something major. Hell, it was a good-sized room. You know. But, see, to me and to us and to Joe and I, it looked like that what Grant was for was to find the body. If in fact there was foul play involved, and I'll say if because I do not know, maybe if foul play was involved, then Grant's job was to find the body. but instead, it was found by the lighting technician, burglar alarm guy that went there to put the burglar alarm in the greenhouse. Now, it was Seattle. It rains in Seattle all the damn time. Everybody knows that. It didn't rain in anything else. There were no other footprints in the room, leading in or out. And no muddy boot prints or nothing like that. Nothing that would look like anybody else that came in or gone out. I mean, so you can take that for what you want. That doesn't mean somebody else wasn't there. It just means they didn't leave footprints. They may have been already in the house. They wouldn't have left footprints in that case. You know, I don't know. But in any event, at this late date, you know, most of the police officers involved are either long retired or deceased. Cobain's body was cremated. The man, the doctor that did the autopsy is dead. Dr. Hartshorn's dead. I mean, there's really nowhere to go with it. You got a lot of questions, but there's nowhere to get the answers from. I mean, there are people that would swear that, oh, she's guilty. Courtney Love had something done. She did it. Okay, well, proof would be good here. You know, if you're going to show some proof.
Who has the most motive?
Well, yeah, she definitely would have supposedly had motive, because if he would have divorced her, she'd have been in deep stuff. But motive alone, I mean, how many wives out there have motive to kill her husband and vice versa? You know, if motive made you guilty of murder, we'd all have to be in jail. It's not enough. Show me anything. Show me something that puts anybody with the body at the time, and you might could get something done. Show me any paper trail that shows him in a specific place after the second day of April. Anything. Show anything. Something to track down. You might have something to work with. Now, like I said, I have no side in this. I'm not for Courtney Love or against her, or for or against Tom Grant, although Tom Grant did, when we came out with our stuff on the shotgun shell in the report, he did go on comments on YouTube and just laid into us like we laid rails. And we shut him down. We pulled out the calipers and the set and the specs for the shells, and we measured them, and we said, here it is, argue with it. And he couldn't, and he shut up in the hall.
2.5-inch shells are really rare. Yeah, everything's 2 3/4 super old. Predominantly, I think they might still be in use in some European countries, but in the United States, you know, everything's, you know, 2 3/4, 3-inch, 3.5.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's just what it is. Because, I mean, I was a gun person. I had all kinds of guns. I had shotguns and handguns. And I used to load rifle ammunition. And so I knew about the firearms. And I knew that 2.5 inches was wrong when I saw it on the report. You know, I said, all right, that's the dram weight. That's the powder weight of the shell, you know. But what are you going to do? I mean, it's obviously a mistake. And on its face, it may have been enough time to get someone to look at it. But it's, you know, it's over, what is it now, 94?
94
to 14, 20, we're talking about 20, what, 26 years, something like that?
Yeah, quite a bit of time.
It's a good bit of time, and there's no way. You know, people's memories fade, people die, fire, moon.
And one interesting side note is Kurt Cobain was a member of the 27 Club, just like Hendrix and Joplin and Morrison. Yeah. I thought that was kind of an interesting parallel.
Well, now,
there's other stuff. I mean, there were things I haven't even gone into about this that I could go into, but we don't really have time. There was one guy named Eldon Hoag. His stage name was El Duce. He was a singer of some kind, and he claimed that Courtney Love offered to pay him $50,000 to blow Kurt Cobain's head off with a shotgun. And he took a lie detector test that was administered by the top lie detector analyst in the country. He passed. Now, that in and of itself doesn't mean a lot, because a habitual liar can beat a lie detector test, and a lie detector test aren't enough in court. So that doesn't really do a lot. Of course, Mr. Hoag was hit and killed by a train not long after that happened, so that's kind of mysterious. It's just one of the many things that we find about this. Everywhere you go down it, there's little alleyways that take you to nothing.
All right, Michael, if you'll hold on a minute, I want to ask Robin McCray, who is one of our Mind Speak practitioners. And are you getting any vibes about this, Robin?
Well, yes and no. Kurt Cobain was very troubled, especially at the time of his death. I mean, about a lot of things. He was also fearful that somebody was going to kill him. I mean, regardless of who actually did it, he was aware that there were people that wanted him dead. And his state of mind, of course, he was having the drugs anyway, so there's that filters into it. Courtney Love, on the other hand, she portrayed herself as one way about him to the public, and it was completely different behind closed doors. And their relationship, I don't think, had ever been what you would call good. I mean, love aside, it got very physical. And there's a side to her that people don't see. And that's a concern. But he was worried. He was concerned about his life. He was concerned about someone trying to kill him.
Okay.
I think it's a very good possibility. And I think that when it comes to any, and John, we go through this, Tony, you know this, Devin, you as well. We go through these cases, and when you're talking about a high-profile case, the first thing everybody investigates on it is to shut it down as quick as possible. None of these cases are ever what they appear. They just aren't. And go ahead.
I was going to say, well, look at JonBenet Ramsey. That case bothers me to this day. Somebody killed a little girl. And I could have done a better investigation than they did. But you're right. If it's high profile, you give it 24 hours and you set it down, because you don't want to deal with it.
Or you wait 72 hours like they did in Chris Benoit. But anyway, Robin, do you get any other communication from anybody, or is it just all quiet on the Western Front?
No, it's not so much quiet as it is. I don't want to say it's disgruntled. It's more, he takes blame for part of it. I think that part of him thought about doing it to himself. I'm not convinced that he's the one that actually pulled the trigger. I mean, he had suicidal thoughts. He had had them on, from what I'm getting, he's had them on and off for many, many years, where he just got so frustrated he felt like that was the only option left. But he was also fearful that somebody else was coming for him. Now, whether or not, I don't know who it is, I just know that there was, From what I'm getting, it was a man. Now, that's not to say that Courtney did not hire this man, okay? But he was aware that there was somebody coming for him, and he wanted to get away. Now, he had suicidal tendencies. He had had suicidal tendencies his whole life. So, you know, it could have been a matter of maybe he thought he was going to kill himself before this other person got to him, or maybe this guy got to him before he did it. But there's conflict on both sides there. It was not just a simple matter of he decided to kill himself and this is what he was going to do. This had been building. The whole situation had been building and building for months. And he was aware that someone was trying to kill him. I don't think there were, my personal opinion is there was more than one attempt that had already been made. And I keep getting shown pictures of cars trying to run him off the road and that type of thing. So he was aware of it. And, you know, whether or not Courtney is the mastermind of the whole thing, I'm not even going to go into that. Do I think that she knew about this situation? Absolutely, yes. That doesn't mean it's her fault he died, but I am saying that she was absolutely aware of the whole situation. But there is much more to it than just the simple thing of did he kill himself or did he get murdered. It was much deeper than that.
Well, my big question is, what's the money trail? Was there a life insurance policy on his head? And was that made payable to Courtney Love? Michael, do you know the answer to that?
I don't have specifics in the amounts, but she was a spouse, and it ended up that because they had a minor child, what I understand was a trust for their daughter Frances, who was a minor child. Everything he had pretty much went to Frances in a trust, and she was the executor of the trust until Frances turned 21.
Yeah, what I'm getting is everything he had, everything was meant for her. But Courtney had her hands in it until she was 18.
Oh, yeah.
Which she could have lived off the interest off of it, you know?
Well, yeah, it was loaded. I mean, you know, there's all the royalties off all the music and it's merchandise and, you know, all this stuff. But, you know, like I said, we went at it solely on the basis of the paperwork that we had, the case reports, the photos, the credit card reports, what little we could get from the autopsy, the blood levels and that kind of thing. We tried to stay as neutral as possible. So we could be objective. You know, we didn't want to come into one camp or the other because, you know, we've had people come online and swear to us that she did it and, you know, I just know she did it. Well, how come? Why? What proof do you have? Well, no, I don't have any, but I know she did it. Well, that doesn't help. You know, if you have proof that someone committed a crime, you know, fess it up. Tom Grant had stated that he had proof that she was involved, but he's never come forward with any of it. If he had it, you know. So, like I said, we didn't want to get into the rat race of being in one camp or the other. We just wanted to look at the facts as we get them and make our own conclusions and ask our own questions if we could find any answers. And so far, sadly, we really haven't. I cannot tell you to this day, one way or the other, what happened for sure to Kurt Cobain. I don't know. I can make a case for murder, and I can make a case for suicide, and they're pretty much both equal. If all you take is just the facts of the case, I can't say one over the other.
Well, here's go ahead, Tony.
The greenhouse. Was it a dirt floor, or it's a kind of random question.
It was a wood floor. It had French doors. Had a wood floor. Had a concrete walkway around it outside. And then the doors were locked. The French doors were locked. The fire department had to break in a pane of glass to reach in and open the door to gain entry.
Do you know if they dusted the doorknob?
The area was dusted. From what I understand, they identified no prints. They didn't mention any prints that were listed that belonged to anyone in this file. The pen that he used to write the note, whoever wrote the note, I'm assuming it was, I'll say it was him because I don't know different. When the note was written, it was lay on a bed of dirt, like a, you know, big plastic trays full of potting soil that you put plants in.
Right.
The note was lay on top of that, and then the pen was driven down into the note, through the note, into the dirt to hold it in place. And they dusted the pen with a little plastic big pen kind of thing.
Right.
They dusted the pen and got no prints. They dusted the gun and got no prints. Well, that's not surprising because gun oil and everything in a gun case, you put a gun back in a gun case and the prints are pretty much gone. You know, all the oil is going to just run all over it. There was a box root beer can that was partially full. And it does not mention there if they dusted the can or not. The can probably held water because when you I don't know if anybody and I've never done it myself obviously, but when you take heroin to make morphine, you have to inject a small amount of water into the spoon when you heat it to liquefy it. Because it's too thick otherwise. It won't draw into a needle. So you have to have a little bit of water on the spoon with the heroin when you light it with a lighter underneath it to liquefy it, and then you draw it into a syringe. So there has to be a small amount of water. And if they didn't say what the contents of the can were, if it was root beer or if it was water. But I'd have to say, unless he was injecting the root beer in with his heroin, that it probably had water in it, but I don't know that.
It looks like that they would have got a partial off of the trigger, you know, but that just seems like some botched police work, doesn't it?
Oh, well, even the chief of police there, later, he did a Reddit thing, a Live Reynolds Live Reddit talks or whatever, and said that he wished that he could go back and redo it, and he would do it different. Because it looked to me like it was really very rushed. And
do you know if he was right-handed? Was Cobain right-handed or left-handed? Which the reason I'm asking is, which hand was the barrel? You talked about the hand convulsed. Was it in his left hand, the barrel in his left hand, or his right hand?
Let me see if I can find that. We have that at one point. I think he was left-handed.
You see where I'm going with that?
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because the gun would have rotated, and the shotgun shell would have been on the wrong side of the body. And initially they thought that because, and they even mentioned that here. Let me get that. I'll read it to you real quick. I know y'all got.
No, this is great. This is interesting.
Let's see here. When I first looked, this is a weapons specialist from the CLPD writing this. When I first looked at the 35mm crime scene photo, I noticed that the Remington 20 gauge shotgun was lying on the victim's chest with the receiver facing up. I also observed a spent yellow shell case laying on a coat on the right side of the photo. In the magazine, I could observe a yellow round not fully chambered and appeared to have malfunctioned. I was aware that the spent casing to have landed to the victim's left, the weapon would have had to have been turned 180 degrees from how it was found. It appeared evident to what had happened when the weapon was fired, but I requested assistance from SPD range officer who showed the victim holding the weapon but did not identify the victim. The officer stated that the round fired would have ejected in the direction where it was found, and the second round probably malfunctioned due to the victim holding the barrel, which prevented the free movement of the barrel. The weapon probably pivoted when fired and fell to the present position. Held in this manner, the round would have ejected to where it was depicted in the photo. The ammunition was Winchester 20-gauge target load. The wound victims sustained were consistent with the effect of a wound that came from a 20-gauge shotgun with target load ammunition.
Right, because that's going to be, it's that close, it's not going to, it's only, you know, it's not the high brass stuff. He's probably shooting low brass target load, but still going to do a number on that, you know, point blank.
Actually, it was Winchester, according to this, it was Winchester double A.
Right,
here
right.
It says
this
also,
there's been a target, there's been something to shoot, shoot, skeet with, or probably 7.5 or 8.
They always shot. It says inside the bag, there was a bag on here, it goes, inside the bag contained the shotgun shells. I recovered a sales slip for $6.95, which was dated 4/2/94. On the box of 20-gauge ammunition, there's a price mark, $6.95, from Seattle Guns.
Mm.
Seattle Guns was where the shells were bought. The gun was bought somewhere else. So whoever went in the taxi cab initially that morning to look for bullets and had stopped to get something to eat made their way to Seattle Guns and bought the shells.
Okay.
Those are the ones that were found on the scene in the bag.
And cameras were probably weren't wide use back then, but I would have just asked for sake of argument, if I'd have saw that on the box of shells, I would have went straight to the establishment and seen if they had security cams and had them pull their footage if they did, which they probably, you know, back in 94, they probably did. You know.
Well, even still, you just say, hey, did someone match in this description come in and buy a box of shotgun shells at the time of the morning?
Right,
that would have been enough.
Yeah, and it's going to be on the register. What time? I mean, because the register is going to have a record. Yeah, on sales slip, it's going to have a record of what time those shells were purchased.
I mean, you know,
anyway,
because if it comes out the fact that the guy that bought the shotgun shells was 6'5" and had red hair or something.
There we go. That's exactly right. So do you? Is there anything that shows that Seattle PD asked any questions? Did they go to the gun shop? Did they, or just write it off as just rock star suicide?
Well, as far as I can tell, and I'm not going to quote myself on this too much because I'm still looking at it. Like I say, we end up going back to this thing. We said we're going to be done with it. We never are. I wake up in the middle of the night and have a question. I write it down and go back and look for it. But as far as I know, they never went and checked on that. But I don't know for sure. If they did, they didn't. If they did, it's not on the paper that I've got.
Right.
And it's also been noted that the case file is not complete. They said that it's possible some parts of it are missing, so I don't know for sure. But what I've got to hear, it doesn't mention it.
Okay. Well, hey, Michael, I want to put a pause on everything right now. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to give each one of our panelists a chance to do the one-minute question round to ask you a question and see what kind of an answer you can give based on the discussion which we've had, which has been wonderful. So who wants to go first? Who wants to ask the first question to Michael?
I'll go first.
Okay.
How did you start researching all of this? Were you a fan, or did you live in the area?
No. My friend Joe, my research partner Joe Wallen, that I did the Paranormal Night Stalker with, our investigation group, our podcast network. He was a fan of Kurt Cobain. I admittedly wasn't. I really wasn't my kind of music, to be honest, and I really didn't know much about Kurt Cobain. And he said, you know, look at the Kurt Cobain thing. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, there's a question whether or not it was a suicide like it was reported, or it was a homicide. I said, well, I'll never look at it. He said, we should look at it. So I said, okay. So we found out that we could look at the police report and photos online. So we actually downloaded them, have them, and it's probably 3,000 pages of documents. And that's what we use to look at our case. And we'll look at anything. We look at everything. We looked at Bigfoot. We looked at UFOs. We looked at paranormal stuff, hauntings, poltergeists, you name it. If you want it looked at, we'll look at it.
Well, and I sure appreciate all the research you've done, and thank you for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Devin. And now, next. Hey, Robin, we haven't heard from you in about 10 minutes. Have you got a question for Michael?
Well, back to the motive thing. Was there ever anything done, Michael, where you guys like sat down and made a list of everybody in his circle that would have had that motive, why they would have had that motive, and then traced their movement during that time frame or even for like 6 months back to see if you can pin some kind of connection? Obviously, I'm not going to say that he didn't commit suicide, but there's just not enough there that leads me to believe that that's what happened. I mean, he's still having his shoes on. That couldn't have been possible for what he did. Mysteriously, every fingerprint is gone on absolutely everything. That doesn't happen. I mean, maybe once there'd be a slip up on one thing, but not everything. Okay. The man is barely cold, and they've already given an autopsy reading that they possibly could not possibly have thoroughly done in the amount of time span that they had. And then the body's cremated. And as you yourself said, every lead goes to a dead end because either somebody dies mysteriously or this is gone. So I guess my question is, did anybody ever do a complete profile of everybody in his circle and then go back like 6 months to see the behavior patterns of those people just to see if there's anything that could be tied into anything?
Well, oddly enough, we tried. The obvious person to look at would have been Courtney Love. She was his wife. They were married. They had a minor child. If anything happened to him, all of his assets would have gone to her or the child because they were immediate family, barring some kind of a legal document or something, I would imagine, like that. And there were lots of what we call hangers-on, people that were around. Now, with all the drugs and stuff in use, and obviously drugs are a big part of this, you know, I mean, you got some guy that's rich giving out heroin. You're going to have people at the house. You know, if you're a drug addict and, oh, old buddy Kirk's got a whole bunch of drugs, let's go to Kirk's house, you know. So there's going to be people in that circle that you know, and sadly enough, and I'm not trying to make a blanket judgment on anybody, but, you know, people that are addicted like that, they get bad enough beats for a fix. They'll do a lot.
Yeah, but I don't think this was a drug hit. I'm not saying it wasn't.
Well,
I'm just saying my own opinion. But my other question
is, I don't think it was either. I think if anybody actually had if Kurt Cobain was murdered, and I'm saying was because I have no idea. Even with all I've done, I can't give you a one way or the other. If Kurt Cobain was murdered, the person that would have benefited the most would have been Courtney Love.
Okay, but Courtney, how far back did you guys monitor what her movements were? Phone calls,
well,
transactions, people she hung around.
Well, the problem is with her being a celebrity, she travels a lot, but she travels private. And you can't access the travel records of an airline or a police officer, the department could, you know, could look into that and find out. But a private person like me, I can't call up Delta Airlines and ask how many times a person has made airline flights in the last 6 months. They're not going to tell me.
Right.
You know, so you have that issue. And because a lot of what they did was travel privately, they chartered a jet. Unless you knew the tail number of the jet and where it left from and the destination for the flight plan, it was filed flight plans of public record. But unless you know the tail number of the airplane and the departure and the destination, you can't find it. So it's very hard to do that. We tried to do that, but there were people involved here, like Kelly DeWitt, who was Frances Bean's nanny, for lack of a better word, kind of her sitter, was here. And then there was Dylan Carlson, who was Kurt's friend, who bought the gun that was used. Then there was there were other people involved. There was the drug dealer in Seattle that they always used. You know, there were other people involved. There were people in L.A. that were with Courtney when she was arrested. And then, you know, she brought Tom Grant in, and Tom Grant went to Seattle with another guy and stuff. I mean, not that Tom Grant was involved in what happened to Kurt Cobain, but he was all part of it. It was all in the mix. You know, and to try to pin somebody down as far as movement and crossing paths and trying to establish a timeline, we tried it. It was impossible. We just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, if I had the resources and enough juice behind my name and could have got airline records, and maybe you might could do it, but it's almost impossible to get that kind of stuff. That'd be kind of like me trying to find out where you were last week, because, you know, your doctor's not going to tell me if you were in his office, or your travel agent's not going to tell me if you flew to Bermuda, or, you know, they're not going to give up private information like that.
Well, now, Michael, hold on. My doctor will tell you that I was talking to him about the Mandela effect at a McDonald's. Now, he'll tell you that. That's actually true.
Well, that sounds like something your doctor would tell me, because it sounds like it'd be something that doesn't happen very often.
Well, we'll get him back next time. But anyway, look, that's a great explanation. I want to make sure Tony has a chance to answer a question, and then I'll ask one to wrap us up. So thanks. That was a good answer to Robin's question. Tony, what's your final question for Michael?
I really don't have a question, just a statement. Michael's done an outstanding job with research, and this has been one of my favorite shows so far, the detail that's went into this. For him to answer the questions so specifically, he's put a lot of time in this.
Well, I appreciate that. I wish Joe could have come on because Joe and I worked this together, and I have to share credit immensely all the way down the line, because we work on this thing sometimes from 7 o'clock in the morning to midnight, you know, over Skype, comparing notes and firing questions back and forth and looking at reports and looking up websites and doing all this stuff and losing sleep and, you know, and I wish he could have been here to help me with this, because he would have loved it. I would have loved to have had him on. I kind of told him it was one of the best things he'd ever done and the worst thing he could ever done to me was this. I swear I want to beat him sometimes to put me on this one, because I can't leave it alone.
You've done a great job.
It kind of gets you, you know. Once you get into it and you don't want to quit, because I really would like to get an answer, but I'm not going to get one, I don't think.
Well, one never knows, sir. And I guess I'd like to close with a question. I want to close with a question. Mark Furman, one of the most famous detectives ever, wrote a book and got a man sent to jail 25 years after the fact. It was one of the Kennedys. Now, why can't any one of these books that implicates a murder, why can't that be an excuse to reopen the case? Why?
Well, that was the same question we asked when we contacted Seattle PD and said, you know, your ballistic report's wrong. Your ballistic report from your own crime lab is inaccurate. And there's nothing in writing that we could find that ever corrected that. So it seemed to us that they could have reopened the case on just the fact that the ballistic report was inaccurate would have been enough to relook at the case. But what are you going to look at? The body's cremated. At the time, the gun was missing in action, even though it was later found to be inoperative. You've got no body to re-examine. You've got no firearm test. But you're right. I mean, just what would it take to get it reopened? Tom Grant, by his own admission, has said, and he's in the camp that believes that Courtney Love had something to do with Kirk's death, and that he has some proof of this. But he's never come forward with it, as far as I know, because as far as I know, he's never been charged, or anyone else has been charged in this case. So you're right. I don't know. I don't know what it would take to get it relooked at. I think the case was probably mangled so bad at the beginning that nobody will touch it. The initial case was botched. The medical examiner was a friend of the victim. You know, there were lots of, even though that may have nothing to do with it, but still, it smacks of impropriety. You know, it doesn't look good on paper.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you what. We have run out of time tonight on one of the most interesting Murder 123 podcasts we've ever had. I want to thank Michael Smith for being here and talking to us about Kurt Cobain. I want to thank our investigators, Robin McRae, Devin Tate, and Tony Filosi. And until next week, this is Dr. John Stamey. We'll be back for another great case on Murder 123. So everybody have a great weekend.
Take care, everyone.
Yes, yes.
And we'll see you.
Great show, guys.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Great show.